Yeah. What's up, people? It's No Guitar Is Safe, the guitar show where guitar heroes plug in. We got Dan Peters in the house today, Chicago-based guitar ace. We're at Todd Mills' studio here, Todd and Christy's house. This is brought to you by Guitar Player Magazine and GuitarPlayer.com. Guitar Player, play better, sound better. And by the way, during this interview, I'll also be flying in some MP3s from Dan. So you'll be hearing some of his music. Oh, he's going crazy. Somebody get the fire extinguisher. He's on fire. He's on fire.
Oh, I'll tell you, tough crowd, you know.
Hey, that's pretty good, man. You got any actual jokes in that voice?
I'll tell you, my wife, she's no prize, you know. She likes to talk to me when we're having sex. The other night she called me from a hotel room.
Oh, man, it brings me back. That's actually some solid Dangerfield right there, man.
I'll tell you, I'm ugly, you know. I stick my head out the window. I got arrested for mooning. Are you kidding me?
Oh, that's classic, man. He's with us, folks. He is with us. Rodney's here.
Yes.
Dan Peters in the house.
Jude Gold.
In Todd's house, I should say. Hi. Todd Mills, Screaming Kitty Studios.
Hello.
Yes.
Thanks, somewhere man. West of Chicago, Illinois. Pretty close.
Villa
west
Park.
Being a good word because you've got the West Side Winders.
That's right.
And you seem to be moving west.
I'm even further west now.
Yeah. And that is a sick band that you got.
Slick Black Cadillac Daddy, Chariot of Doom. Slick Black Cadillac Daddy.
I know you have a thing you like to do, or a genre of your own, kind of shredabilly. Yes. I was thinking, like, the solo on Scary Harry is just a fantastic kind of example of what I would think of as shredabilly.
Thank you. That, you know, when I came up with the concept, it wasn't, you know, wasn't very original. It was a lot of stolen parts. I kind of looked at the original rockabilly, you know, those guys came out and a lot of those players were coming from various backgrounds, jazz, country, rhythm and blues, and they kind of created this whole new genre, which was part of early rock and roll. And I thought, why not throw a few more things into that stew? And later on, that the whole rockabilly scene adopted surf music, you know, so the whole Dick Dale thing kind of became part of that. And then I grew up listening to hard rock and metal, so I kind of wanted to take all of those influences and add it to that kind of genre.
Anyone is not 100% familiar with Mr. Peters here, you do a lot of this stuff on this Gretsch that you're holding.
This is true.
Beautiful 6120, I would say.
It is, yeah.
Can you show us a little bit of just how you use this thing in the different contexts that most people might not expect to hear some of the sounds that you get?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, because Brian Setzer will have, he'll have a little bit of grit entered in a slapback echo. And people don't realize you can actually control, it's not going to be out of control feedback if you've got some higher gain settings on it.
Yep, and every once in a while I'll hear that Bigsby come in there on your tracks.
Yeah, and I love the sound of the Bigsby, and it, you know, it's not, you're not going to do major dive bombs. It's more of a little bit of a quaver. Is that a word? Yeah,
I'm holding this Music Man over here. You got the Gretsch and the GDAC amp, which is a good amp to have in the trunk of your car, right?
Yes, which I don't believe they make these anymore. I got them, I don't even know if they had them out for that long, but I picked one up because I thought it was really, I think last time I saw you at the NAMM show was when I saw that they were, you know, making these, and it's a great practice amp, and it's, I use it whenever my students come over, you know, and it's just got killer built-in tones.
Yep. And drum loops.
Who would have thought? Yes.
So, and you have so many great examples of the stuff from Sidewinders, the West Sidewinders, and that album. I remember that album when you, I don't know how, if it came out before I met you or.
Yeah.
But Snakin' Not Stirred.
Snakin' Not Stirred came out in 2006. And then the previous one, when we were just the Sidewinders, was Come and Get It. That was 2004. So, yeah, holy crap, 20 years ago.
Oh, yeah, that's nothing nowadays.
Yeah.
20 years used to be a lot, but it's pretty recent. It's this millennium.
Yes, exactly. Not like the old days when they were cranking out an album a year.
Yep, so I was digging Little Doggies.
Yes.
Do you play that one? I think I learned it.
Oh, that's right. We played it at Guitar Superstar.
No, I mean, I learned it this morning.
Did you?
Maybe we played it back then at the Guitar Superstar.
Oh, dude, I honestly haven't played that song in...
Oh, well, I'll fly it in here so people can hear it. It's
badass. There we go.
Now, Guitar Superstar, that was an event. Guitar Player Magazine, we started Guitar Hero. It was the first couple years of that.
Oh.
And this is all Mike Melendez, the editor at the time. For a long time, he was editor. His brainchild. That's the reason you probably got that bag of goodies, because, you know, he's thinking, like, it's like the Oscars and stuff. We'll give them all, get some sponsors to donate some stuff, that cool Snapjack cable that you still have. That's
right.
Dope. And, but, you know, I think, who made the video game? Guitar Hero, is it Activision? I don't know. I don't know what the legal story was, but I think basically they had bigger lawyers than we did, and they were like, no, we're keeping the name Guitar Hero now. They came out after us, but we had to give it up. So then when you came around, it was Guitar Superstar. And that was a rocking event, man. Like,
yes,
five of you guys, or 10 of you guys, duking it out. Standing room only crowd.
Yeah.
Kind of like American Idol. We had the judges up there.
Right, yeah. And it was, and the one I was involved with was Joe Satriani, Steve Vai, Elliot Easton.
Yeah.
Andy Summers was there.
Yeah, he was the host.
He was host, right. George Lynch.
Yeah.
And who else? There was another couple of guys.
I mix up the different years, but Kotzen was there and Lukather.
That was, I think, the year before.
Yeah.
And I remember you telling me. I think it was the year. You were like, when Neil Sean was there, and you said those guys partied really hard.
Oh, yeah, that's very possible. That was before, I think that was before Luke, you know, went sober.
Right.
So he's totally sober. He used to party a little bit on one of those, a couple of those early ones.
It's amazing.
I remember one morning, I mean, he shut the bar down. I was, you know.
Yes,
And Trevor Lukather were there. I was like, one of my duties was to take them the next morning. This is before the competition. Take them to this radio station. Like, we had a ride all arranged, him and Joe Satriani. Take him to do a 8 a.m. morning interview. That means like 7:30. It's like 7:31. I'm like, oh no, Luke, man, he was kind of tore up last night. He showed up at 7:31. He's like, I bet you didn't think I was gonna fucking be here, motherfucker. I've been doing this a long time. It was classic.
That's outstanding.
Yeah, Luke will never let you down, man.
I, you know, when I was going to school at GIT, I used to see Steve Lukather out at some of the local bars, the Rainbow, yeah. and what have you. And we went and saw him play with Los Lobotomies, and he had a tray, you know, an actual waitress tray of shots of Jägermeister on his amp.
Oh, wow. Well, we got to give him the full credit of being so sober and
yes,
for a
absolutely
God 12 years now or something.
That's outstanding. Good
you
for
know,
him.
And he's you know he'll be the first to tell you how fortunate he feels that you know unlike some of his friends. You
yes.
Know. All right, but let's play a couple notes, man. I wonder what should I play for you? What rhythm guitar thing or
okay? Where you want to play?
I don't know, man.
Okay, let's do. I don't know.
Yeah, you go ahead. Take some liberties. Stuff to be illegal on a Gretsch.
Whoa,
that's so awesome.
Yeah, and I think that circling back to the whole shreddability thing is I don't think people expect to hear someone play like that on this type of guitar.
Yeah,
even though it's clearly you can do it, you know. I mean, anyone, it's I just love the tone of this guitar, you know.
Yeah, it's one of my, you know, I think we all have guitars that maybe we think we have all the guitars we need, but there's one that we fucking need. I need a 6120, you know.
It's, you do.
Yeah, it's just so blatantly lacking. I think we all, you know, I got to our one of our techs that we had worked with before, Tyler Sweet, he also worked for Brian Setzer, and he took me over to Brian Setzer's rehearsal pad, or not a storage space, you know, and took out one of, he was trying shit out, you know, just dusting things off. Man, I played one of those 6120s through the Fender Bassman with the Echoplex on top, or what does he use? Space Echoes? Roland Space Echo?
Yeah, I think he uses a Space Echo, yeah.
That shit was amazing. I mean, it was loud, too.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it gets not as loud if you're on a giant stage, but like in a smaller room, bouncing off the walls. Holy Toledo.
It was actual Setzer's gear.
Yeah, absolutely.
Holy cow, dude. That's amazing.
It was a great moment. It's just like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
It was dope.
I can imagine.
Hope I'm not getting Ty in trouble, but he was just dusting them off.
Right.
I think we were
like,
helping.
Hey, man.
Oh. You know, because they had to do that whole inventory before the tour with all the Christmas toys and the stuff for the Christmas thing.
So how many Gretches does he have?
Oh, I don't know. He's got maybe all of them.
It's and I know he had that famous, it was the 1959 one, which is, I believe they had it put it through an X-ray machine or an.
That's what they'll do, right? When they're making a signature model
right.
or something.
Yeah.
And they do that with Strats and stuff too.
I had another one at one point, and then it was like going through a period where things were kind of slow, and so I sold it. And I'm still sorry that I sold that second Gretsch. I had a Silverjet at one point as well too. That was very mid rangey, throaty sounding. I didn't quite care for the tone on that one, but. White Falcon. Yeah, you remember. And a White Falcon would be my next, if I could get another electric guitar, would be that.
Nice, yeah.
Didn't
like,
I help you sell the Duo Jet?
You might have.
It was around the time I was talking for you, and you were looking to sell the Duo Jet, and we put it on eBay or something.
Yeah, and then I was so mad because you sold it for a bag of Coke.
Yeah, that's,
you know. You son of a...
Todd and Luke both cleaned up. But
that
would
that's right.
We're just kidding around.
I did.
Well, I won't let the public know. You know,
in public, you are.
You can edit that, right?
Well, at my discretion.
Sure.
Let's see what kind of payola I can get from you to take that out. No. Anyway, it's cool to be in your studio here, man. You were smiling while Dan was blazing on the guitar there. You looked pretty happy.
two of my very good friends, and at some point both of you are my employers, so to speak.
That's right.
I'm tech for both of you, and it's kind of a proud moment for me.
Dope. Very great to be here, and it always feels weird when you have a really good friend who technically is kind of your employee, but
right.
You know, sometimes I feel like we work for you a little bit because you keep us going.
That's the way it should be.
Not really.
It's not really, but you know, you'll be like, hey, this is what I need. And manage your boss, as they say. Or
manage your expectations.
I remember when Todd was telling me, too, you and I have known each other. We don't see each other often, but I've known you since 2007, maybe?
Before that, Buffalo Niagara.
2006?
The other guitar competition where I was a judge. Buffalo Niagara.
Holy cow. Yeah. But he was excited when he did, I think, that first show with you guys, and I think you guys hit it off so well that you hired him, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's impossible to, I mean, as far as I know, everyone hits it off with Todd. He's just so chill. You've done, of course, so many different things. Like, I was checking out the D. Snyder, Lizzie Hale thing, and that's like a blazing solo in the middle of a Christmas jam.
That was, so I met Dee, I was, our mutual friend Joel Hoekstra was kind enough to hire me to be one of his subs for Rock of Ages on Broadway. And at one point while I was doing the show, filling in for him, I think he was on tour with TSO at the time, we finished the show. I know you've seen it, great, awesome show, one of the best shows I've ever enjoyed playing. So we're putting the guitars away, and all of a sudden I hear this gruff voice. So that is your real hair. And I turn around, and it's Dee Snyder. I went and chatted with him for just a brief moment. And then a year later, he was having auditions for this Christmas rock musical that he wrote, which took a bunch of Twisted Sister songs and kind of morphed them into Christmas songs.
Yeah.
It was a real, very fun, cool idea.
Funny.
And so that was how he and I became friends, and he was in the show, and I was hired to be a character in the show, a long-haired aging guitar player. It was a big stretch. And
you're growing into the role.
Yes.
Daisy Cutter.
Yeah. So and then that was one of the songs that was in the show, is that Celine Dion recorded a version of it, and you know, people heard her version first without, I think, even realizing that that was an actual Dee Snider song. And so he wanted to eventually come back and record it himself, and he got Lizzie Hale on the track, which is kick-ass, and the whole thing was produced by Jeff Pilson. So that was cool. It was a great opportunity that led me right back to playing loungers.
Oh, no, these, everything goes up and down, so roll the roller coaster.
Exactly.
And how did you record that blazing solo?
It just at my house. At the time, I was. This is before I got divorced, and then Dee called me up. I think I was just even called to wish him a happy Father's Day, you know. And then he said, "I'm so glad you called. I have this song. I'm going to record that Christmas song. Would you play the guitar solo on it?" And I was like, "Hell yeah!" So next thing I know, Jeff Pilson called me and said, "I'm just going to send you the tracks." And I use Presonus Studio One, which I like a lot. And they just, they just emailed the tracks to me. I laid down the solo. I think the first one I did, he said, "It's a little bit tame. Can you do something crazier?" Like, you know, he's like, really show off. So that second solo that I sent is the one that's on there.
Yeah, that is blazing, man. You played all the notes in there.
Thank you. Yeah, I tried to, I don't even know what I was going for. I think there was like I was tapping out arpeggios for the chord progression, you know, that sort of
thing. But where were you getting the tone from plugins?
Oh, the tone. So the tone itself was, oh my God, it was my Boss GT100.
Just going direct?
Yeah. I never used anything that was, you know, I don't even know what you call those, the amp farm things or
plugs.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
It's all zeros and ones now.
So I just plugged into that thing and then into the.
You know, it's funny, circling back to Dee Snider, he really has a thing with Christmas songs too. He really likes that. And like, I think of this song, very famous, everyone knows it, "Come All Ye Faithful." And then I think, we're not going to take it. Yep. I think he's a genius.
Yes.
I think he's grabbing a melody that's kind of, I mean, he did his own twist on it, but it's a triumphant melody that we all know. And now that I see that you're doing the Christmas stuff with him, it's like, I see where he's coming from.
He was a guy that, you know, something always loved Christmas, even though he's Jewish. He convinced the guys, let's do a Twisted Sister Christmas album. And the obvious choice was "We're Not Going to Take It." Because, when he explained that to me, I was like, holy cow. It's like, you know, the same melody.
So did he actually say that?
He did, yeah.
Oh, well, that proves my theory.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just played with him in Key West. It was Rock Island, and there's all kinds of bands over.
Awesome.
Couple of days.
Oh, man.
3-4 days. Todd and I went down one day early to catch Mr. Big, and I think Winger played that day too.
Winger, yep.
So I saw Winger and Mr. Big on the same day, and Night Ranger. Our buddies, and then Wigwam. And we played with Brett Michaels and Trickster. And so many great guitar players. God, man. But, Dee came out with Brett, man, and I think he won of all the performances. Like, he got the crowd so pumped.
Yes.
"We're Not Going to Take It," and then, you know, did some "Highway to Hell."
He's an amazing front man.
He really, he got the crowd
fired the fuck up, man.
So he was just, he didn't even have his own band. He was sitting in with Brett's band.
Yeah. I mean, the crowd was already fired up. This is right. Key West, man. Yeah. People have nothing to worry about down there. They're so loose. And then he took it to another level. So, yeah, it's pretty cool. You got to work with him.
It was the same formula as the Mardi Gras tour.
Okay.
We were on.
Yeah.
Because Brett had Steve Augeri from Journey and
Mark McGrath
from Sugar Ray.
Sugar Ray.
Brett's band learned songs from Journey and songs from...
I wonder if it's all, because there was a thing going for a while that Sebastian Bach was involved with. I forget what they call it. It was a similar thing, but they had kind of an all-star band. So Warren Demartini was playing guitar, and Dee was there, and a few other guys, Lou Graham. But sounds like a similar.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lou Graham was at this one too, actually. Yeah. They played their ass off. So, yes. Now, you do dabble in some zeros and ones sometimes. You had that Strat video with the quad cortex.
Yes.
Just quickly, because I don't want to get too much into nerd land, but someone going back and forth between real amps and a zeros and ones modeler, one of the best that you can possibly get.
Yeah.
What do you think about it? What's your take on going back and forth?
It's weird. I do, and I was really happy to have, because I use the my Boss GT100 for, especially on fly dates or theater, musical theater stuff. And I've used some different things for musical theater. No one likes to have amps anymore in the pit or if you're on stage like Rock of Ages. And I've tried Fractal, Line 6. And and then the quad to my ears, the quad cortex has the most realistic tone.
Yeah.
But I'm still not 100% sold on it either. Like it's a great convenience thing.
Yeah.
And it's nice. So sometimes I do my solo acoustic shows, I will bring my Strat and put it on a Gracie stand.
Oh yeah, I saw it in the video.
Yeah, and then I use a looping pedal because I'm not up there like there's a lot of typical solo acoustic players that are kind of mellow doing the whole James Taylor thing where I'm playing classic rock songs, I'm using a looping pedal, and then sometimes I'll sling the acoustic behind my back, walk up to the Strat and play a ripping rock solo.
Yeah, I saw that. So you call that a Gracie stand. I never knew what those were.
Yes, yeah.
I always call it Alex Lifeson stand.
Right, or a Steve Howe stand.
Steve Howe stand, right. So that's cool.
Yeah.
Oh, really? For a Strat. No, for acoustic.
Dave, the tour manager with Night Ranger, Dave Radley was the one who said, oh, that's a Gracie stand, because we use one with the Christmas act that I tour with, Luminar. And if you look up Gracie stand, it doesn't come up on any music product website. So I think I that was out of a company.
I thought it was kind of common, but then again, I worked in backline, so.
Oh.
I knew it as a Gracie stand.
A lot of people just make them, I think, like Yngwie made his own.
Yeah,
could be.
Yeah.
I would thought you were going to say he made his tech stand there and hold it for him, because I've seen the way he treats guys.
Exactly.
I saw one full Yngwie concert, and it was so fucking entertaining, man.
Yeah.
Because he was blazing, and his tone was amazing. I mean, Yngwie is... Actually, I've seen him twice, but he was just having this ongoing war with his tech the whole time. Like, kind of like they were like, at one point he's like, fuck you. They're playing in the middle of the song and then his tech's flipping him off back, fuck you. But it's almost kind of like a show. Like, it was, the whole dynamic was incredible, man. And he was doing all the kicks and kicking those guitar picks.
Yes.
Drop kicking him.
I saw him a few years ago, and there, it was a similar thing. It was like he was having a battle with his keyboardist at this one. And same thing. You go, is this real or is this just meant to be part of the act?
I think it's kind of real. They're just kind of barking at each other. Like, and I'm not criticizing him because it was an amazing fucking show.
Yeah, he's ridiculous.
A force of nature.
Yes.
And his tone's happening and, single coils through the Marshalls.
It's phenomenal. And it cracked me up, though, that he had, a giant wall of Marshalls. And then his band, his keyboardist, bassist, and drummer were all sort of pushed to the side.
Up into the far right. Yeah. Of the stage.
Yeah. Go big, man. If you're Yngwie, man, you know.
He's so amazing.
I think he only has four of the Marshalls lit, and he's only running out of two of them. I could be wrong.
Okay.
But I think that's the way.
Yeah.
Because I did a couple shows where Yngwie was on the bill, and that was more or less how he did it.
Yeah,
most of those Marshalls, they're real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're for show.
Right.
But he gets great tone out of them.
He's...
And just in case one goes down, he's got a backup somewhere near.
There you go. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, he's amazing. He's truly mind-boggling.
I think that, most of those players, they're only running like two heads max. I don't know how many Malcolm Young ran, but the last time I saw AC/DC, I was in the back of the arena between bands, and the guitar tech came out and did a couple of... through Malcolm's rig, no PA system or anything. Like, it was so fucking loud. That must have been like 4 amps, I think. I'm probably wrong, but it was, I think, the loudest stage rig I've heard.
Wow, that's amazing. I had always heard that he used the 100-watt so that he'd have more headroom and less overdrive. Angus would use the 50-watt head because they're just basically cranking the amps, right?
They got the recipe together.
Yeah.
Now, the musical theater stuff you've done is pretty badass, this Broadway stuff. Now, you did the Mamma Mia one. Are you an ABBA fan, or did you become one? I'm a confessed ABBA fan.
I'm not. I'm still not. And I remember when I did that show, I was like having dreams. Like, I couldn't get the music out of my head. They're so catchy. I have big respect for them. Yeah. But I'm just, it's just not what I want to listen to.
Now, do you remember what's the song, Does Your Mother Know?
Was that in the show? It might have been.
That's like an underrated jam, and the thing fucking rocks. Anyway.
I had a lot of fun playing that show. It didn't make me a fan, but I enjoyed it, and there was a lot going on guitar-wise that I wasn't expecting.
I was going to make you jam on that groove, but... Maybe we can come back to that another day. But because my friend Jay Gore actually got me into that song. It's like, you know what? That is a fucking good song.
Yeah.
Just the way it's arranged and it's got a lot of energy. Tell us, like, what are some of the most, me and Todd love Spinal Tap moments. And, where things go awry, but the show goes on. Maybe it's even really funny or comedy.
Wow.
And these things happen in musical theater, too. Did you guys ever have any funny mishaps? Was it perfect every night or... something happened?
Man, that's the great thing about live theater is that you don't know what's going to happen. I think the funniest thing that happened to me was when I did, there's all kinds of stuff that happens in the pit or happened at Rock of Ages, but nothing that was like ridiculous, aside from like a guitar strap breaking on me when I jumped off the stage and that kind of stuff. But the funniest moment was doing Dee's show, and I was hired as an actor. So I'm playing this role, and Santa Claus makes an appearance at the end of the play, and I'm walking down these stairs to talk to Santa Claus, but I'm also wearing these like Kiss style heavy metal rock boots that are like a foot off the ground, and so I had to walk down these stairs in these boots, and I slipped and kind of went all the way down the stairs, but somehow still landed on my feet. It must have looked pretty awkward.
It must have had a nice big sound. Too.
Yeah. Yes. And I, like, in my head, like, this whole thing is going on forever, and I'm just like, Jesus Christ, no, oh my God. And then I landed, I think I improvised, I said, sorry, Santa, too much eggnog, something like that. Whatever I said got a laugh, and...
Yeah, there you go. You're natural, man.
Yeah.
Maybe not at the boots, but at the acting. That's good.
Acting. Yeah. That was my one foray with acting. I would do it again gladly, but the thing I learned at that time was that, holy cow, the musicians get paid better than the actors.
Interesting.
It's typically the case unless someone becomes, a big star doing a play.
I did some musicals when I was in my early 20s, nothing on the level of what you're talking about, but remember the biggest problem we had one night, it was like night 11, and there's two, me and this other guitar player, and we were in the pit right in front of the audience, not hidden away, and this one guy would come on every night, and he was overacting so much.
Yeah.
And every one of his movements we could predict, and we got the giggle so bad. It was just like, has that ever happened to you? We could not stop fucking laughing. It was so rude. I wanted to stop laughing, right. But you just couldn't.
Yes, that's right. Those it moments was when you're not supposed to laugh, and it's...
I was like, gaff tape my face. Like, what do we do here?
Yeah, like kneeling before the casket, and you're like...
It was actually very stressful. It's like, yeah. How the fuck do we stop laughing? And then it went on for like 10 minutes. I'm sure somebody saw her.
Were you able to play?
Yeah, we were able to play, but yeah. There's some, you know, it was during his monologue.
Right.
I can see it to this day.
That's amazing.
What about any other memorable moments from these musicals that you've done? You've done the Blue Man Group, Rock of Ages, Mamma Mia.
I did the School of Rock musical.
School of Rock musical.
What else did I do? Greece.
Greece.
And then there was a show that they were developing. An East Coast composer playwright couple kind of brought it to Chicago called Skates, or Hit Her with the Skates, I think was the original title. And they were going to debut it in Chicago and hopefully bring it back to New York. But that we did three shows, and then COVID shut everything down. That was it for that. That was the one. I did a show with Blue Man Group when I was in New York. They were developing a new show that didn't get off the ground. But
so let's play another little something or other. Any other side or anything you've been working on, or other side of your playing you want to show? Or I mean.
Maybe some Van Halen?
Oh, I've never seen Van Halen on a Gretsch before. See, Todd's going to hook you up before you show.
So we do now like
play the next part.
Like a right the.
Nice.
Right. Something like that.
Hey, that's beautiful. Been a while. Anytime EVH visits us in the room, you know, it makes me happy.
Yes. Yeah.
But I saw you jamming some Van Halen the other day on one of these videos.
I know you've had a long stint with a Van Halen tribute.
Yeah,
I did a couple of them in the Chicago area, and it's the hardest stuff I've ever had to learn. There's other players that you might think would be more difficult to tackle, like Steve Vai or whatever, but something about the way Eddie played that was so unorthodox and different. And it was hard to wrap my brain around. Did you feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, I felt that way, that it was unorthodox, but I also felt like he was just pushing at everything that we all do, or that Clapton did, or Blackmore, but he just pushed it in a further direction.
Right.
You know, he would bend further.
Right.
Or, you know, people had tapped before, but they never tapped the way he did.
Right. Yes.
He just pushed everything, so...
And it's... I'm so glad...
Like, people say he's alien, but I'm like, no, Holdsworth is alien.
Right.
Eddie is just rock on.
Yes, and
taking down an 11 to he's on like 19.
I'm so glad you mentioned though the bending thing, because that's something people don't think about often. But
like, until what's that one song?
Try to attempt those bends. Yeah,
like that's just something that seems kind of alien.
Yeah,
to take the 12th fret and then the pinky goes down on the second string, but you bend it even further up a two hole set.
Right.
Yeah. Just the way he does that stuff so effortlessly.
Yes. Right.
But it's alien, but it's also kind of just the same stuff we're doing. He's just pushing it a little further.
Yeah. And something about the feel. His feel was different from everybody else.
The groove. I mean,
the whole swing thing that kind of became part, you know, a lot of guys were influenced by him, but a lot of them did not get that sense of swing. Anyway, here we are gushing about.
I would love to know, in addition to Van Halen or whoever, but like, what are some of the truly moving, mind-blowing concerts or guitar performances? You could have been 5 years old, you could have been 30. What just are the concerts that you remember the most that featured a guitar player?
So I started learning to play guitar when I was a freshman, and I was, you know, going to high school in the early 80s. And my very first concert was REO Speedwagon, which was good. But it, you know, was, I wouldn't rate it as one of the all-time great concerts I've been to, but it was really cool first experience. And then the second concert I went to was July 1981. It was Van Halen on their a Fair Warning tour.
Oh.
And it was
bastard.
Yeah, to this day, it was just like it blew my mind. And I had just started learning guitar at the time, and you know, knew enough to know how great Eddie was. And then a month later, I saw Ozzy with Randy Rhoads.
Oh yeah, you're killing me now, man.
Alpine Valley, and yeah, and then that was also, and I was like, oh my god, like two of the greatest rock guitar players of all time.
Yeah, I came on the radar a year later, so I just missed both those. I saw Diver Down.
Yeah.
And then, like, my second concert, well, Diver Down was like my fourth concert. My second concert was Ozzy with Brad Gillis.
Oh, so it was after.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, because like
it was such a short period that Randy was with Ozzy. Yeah. Like, was it even 2 years?
It's like barely 2 years.
Yeah.
So those obviously blew your adolescent mind.
Yes.
But. And then in your later years, once you become like a more of a pro guitar player and stuff, who do you appreciate? Who do you see that just takes you to another level?
The list goes on and on. And I've seen Steve Vai and Joe Satriani.
Yeah.
I've seen Frank Gambale. I remember seeing him was kind of like...
He's an alien.
Yes. And seeing him play, it was playing with Steve Smith with Vital Information. And I was laughing. Like, because it was so crazy good and insane that I was just, I couldn't do anything but laugh because it was so phenomenal.
Yeah. That's so great when the music just makes you laugh because it's so good.
Yes. I've seen Steve Morse. I mean, the list kind of goes on and all these great players. The one guy that that really, truly blew my mind, and I'm a fan to this day, and you can tell by my guitar, was seeing Brian Setzer for the first time. Because I always appreciated him, but wasn't truly aware of how great he was until I saw him live, and it was like, oh my god, this is what I want to do, you know?
Yeah.
And huge, he's just influence.
Cool. Yeah, some dudes are, you know, they just got that cool factor.
Yes. Yes. And, and he does. He has the cool factor, and he was touring with the big band.
Yeah. Yeah.
Truly amazing. Jeff Beck. Yes. I've seen him like 7 times. And every single time. In fact, there's 2 times that I actually was brought to tears by watching someone play. Once was with Jeff Beck when he was touring with the Salute to Les Paul. And the other time was Tommy Emmanuel.
Yeah.
And seeing him do his thing. It was just, you know.
I'm with you. All these moments.
Yeah.
Anyone that you went to see that you weren't expecting to be an amazing guitar player, you weren't even, and then you just, or discovered...
That's a good question.
I can remember I saw The Fix open for The Police. I was like, holy shit, these guys sound great.
I don't know if that's ever happened to me because I'm very picky about my concerts. I won't just go to anyone.
Yeah.
And I seek out great guitar players when I do go see a show. So I'm kind of expecting it. I will say that I think I was way back around college years, or maybe right after, a girl I was dating wanted to see Bryan Adams. So I went, you know, and I was like, wasn't super excited about it, but I like his songs. His guitar player was really great.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he was outstanding. And
Keith Scott.
Yeah, and he's another Gretsch guy, too. He plays Gretsches sometimes.
Did he blow your mind when you saw him? How was Keith Scott? I assume you saw Keith Scott, right?
He was... Again, it wasn't like he was shredding or anything like that. He was very song-oriented. But sometimes you can just tell. Some people just have the right touch, and he had great tone, very tasty, a really nice slide guitar.
See, that blows my mind, too. I mean, even if someone's not playing fancy, they can still just hit one note or great sound. Like, we just did 5 Tom Petty songs as a surprise encore last night with Kathy here in Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, just Mike Campbell.
Mike Campbell.
So much appreciation for him.
Yes. Yeah, fantastic player. Again, not a guy that's, that, you know, people are talking about in the guitar forums, but yet a, you know, a real journeyman.
Yeah, and he kind of blurs the line between lead guitar and rhythm guitar.
Yes.
And does that perfectly, you know. So yeah. I love those kind of players too.
I do too. In fact, I get a little tired. I hope this doesn't sound snobby. I get a little tired of the whole worship of the shredder guys, and so many of them are so great, and I can't do that, you know. But I also feel like it gets focused on too much by a lot of people, and whereas, like we were just talking about, sometimes I just want to hear good music with parts done well. It doesn't have to be.
Oh, come on. Yeah, what's a... I'm thinking of Bryan Adams now.
Yeah.
What a great part.
You're right, yeah.
With the great tone.
That counts for so much more than,
you know, how many notes you could play. It's
the
timing and the feel and the tone and the vibe.
I brought my slide.
Ah, cool. So you play with Otis Rush too, or something?
Yes, and that was kind of a, I know it's.
So
you know,
I went down a rabbit hole today. I mean,
Otis Rush, one of the classic Chicago blues men that probably deserves more acclaim.
Absolutely, what I was thinking after this morning.
Yes, amazing left-handed, just phenomenal. So there was a time in the late 90s.
Probably an influence on Albert King, who's much more famous. And my ears, they just sounds like Albert might have.
Yeah,
pulled some of that. Anyway, as you were saying,
that's right. Yeah, and Albert playing the
lefty thing. Does he play with the upside down too?
Yeah, yeah. So Otis played it upside. Wait, did he? No, he had his strings.
He restrung
in
it
in the right order. Yeah, because he sat in with I was in a swing band in the late 90s that had a pretty successful run around Chicagoland, and we did toured Europe a few times. It's called the Big Swing. You remember the Big Swing? And we were touring, and we were also playing, had steady weekly gigs in Chicago, a great place called the Green Mill Jazz Club that we played every Tuesday. And it got to be a thing, and, you know, people like John Cusack and Jeremy Piven would show up, and Otis Rush started hanging out. And, you know, he was like, show up wearing a cowboy hat and overalls, and he just would hang out, and I think he had a little bit of a drinking problem. And eventually he, you know, kind of made his way up and said, can I come up and sing a song with you guys? And we were like, hell yeah. And so he started making it a regular thing. He would just show up on Tuesday. Now he's lefty, and I'm playing, I'm right-handed. So I said, you want to play my guitar? And he's like, I didn't know he was a lefty at the time until he said, no, I'm a lefty. I wish. So he just came out and sang with us. So it's like, it's one of those moments. I've jammed with him on stage, it's like, well, we all kind of inflate our resumes a little bit to say, yeah.
But nonetheless, I definitely had to hear that story because
yeah, it was,
I love it.
It was
like, I just, I don't think I ever heard his song Double Trouble before, man. This is so vibey, man. It's from 1956.
Wow. I hate to make it, you got to try. Baby, there's no lie. Yes, some of this generation is millionaires. It's hard for me to keep these clothes to wear.
I didn't realize that was a 1950s song.
Pretty sure, yeah.
Holy cow.
Because he apparently, from what I...
And that's where Stevie Ray Vaughan got the name for his...
That's my guess, but...
Band, yeah.
Yeah. Well, anything else that we should cover that you've done?
It's like we were talking before. I'm kind of like your typical career working musician. I've had some pretty cool opportunities over the years, and when I look back at it and go, wow, I had some pretty cool stuff. But there's an awful lot of time in between where you're just sort of like, all right, I got to focus on guitar students for a while, or I got to do my solo acoustic gigs, which you know, are plentiful and pay the most money, surprisingly, than when I'm doing a band gig. And
I have infinite respect for anyone who can lead a room full of people just by themselves.
Yeah,
with a guitar. Like, to me, that is graduating to a certain level that most guitar players can't do.
It's,
like what you do when you're not with a band.
It's interesting that it was something I always did, you know, kind of as a supplemental thing. But COVID, you know, when COVID happened and we all kind of like were stuck at home for a few months. And I remember that summer, things started slowly opening up. And it was like, you know, restaurants would have an outdoor patio. And there was a lot of that. And there are a lot of people having socially distant backyard parties. And most of my musician friends were home not working, and I was playing 5 gigs a week. Like that summer, 2020, it was insane. And it kind of like, it kickstarted a part of my career that I had already been doing. And now it's just sort of like, I don't even have to look for it. I get calls for it all the time. The nice thing about it is if something cool comes up, whether it's a tour or a theater show, all my acoustic stuff can I say, listen, I'm going out on tour for a month. I'm going to have to cancel some shows. So it's kind of, it gives you a little bit of freedom to pick and choose other stuff. But I don't know. That was kind of a long-winded. I don't even know if there was a question.
Actually, I have a question. With a lot of what you do, you have the West Sidewinders.
Yeah.
You have your solo acoustic gigs, which are pretty much covers and such. But you also do the Van Halen thing from time to time. I don't think, do you have
not,
a lot
yeah,
of
Yeah, not Van anymore. Halen that there were two different bands, two different Van Halen tributes that I was involved with. And with one, we had a falling out with the singer. And then with another one, the singer moved to Colorado. And that was kind of it. So I play with, the tribute band scene is an interesting thing. It's
what were their names of the two bands?
The first one I was in was called Diver Down, and the second one was Van Halen 2. And that's probably the video you might have seen where I'm doing Eruption and Spanish Fly. That was really fun, and we had some great shows with that band, but that was the guy that moved to Colorado. And I've also play with a Chicago tribute band.
Right, I was going to mention
Chicago
that.
Chicago Tribute Anthology.
And the question I have, though, is how difficult is it for you to shift into each type of gig? Like, so in 1 week, you could be doing your acoustic solo, maybe even a Sidewinders gig, and then a Chicago gig. Are they spaced out long enough to where you can kind of shift your brain into different?
It sort of depends on what's happening. And you know, we all as musicians, sometimes there's a lot of stuff, a lot of different projects happening at the same time. And then I feel like I'm just spending all my time practicing, you know, and it's... so the CTA, as we call it, plays in the summer mostly, with some occasional nightclub gigs during the winter months or theater shows. And so it's like sometimes there'll be 4 or 5 months where we haven't played, and then I know one's coming up. It's like I have to relearn all the tunes, you know. And Terry Kath, another phenomenal guitar player, you know. That took a while, getting to know those songs and those guitar parts. Such a awesome guitar player. And I kind of, after I initially learned everything the way you should play it, I have that Terry Kath influence, but I still play like myself, so to speak. And I, you know, I'll throw in some tapping licks on a Chicago gig. I'm not afraid to do it.
Is there any phrase from any of that awesome Chicago catalog that you could show us, or something cool? Even could be a chord progression, or because I know that music is pretty deep. You know, I don't know all their stuff.
You know what's cool? Just from a rhythm guitar standpoint, I thought this one I really enjoyed learning. Let's see, am I on the right? All right. Optimistic about the way that things are going. So that's that whole, I mean, it's, you know, it's, yeah, all just cool triads, but the voicings are really cool, and so I like that one.
Yeah, it moves around. It's got that cool 70s vibe.
Dialogue, yeah. And, you know, and then the obvious one, 25 or 6 to 4.
The Led Zeppelin song.
There we go.
Well, how is... I don't know who was first. Oh, well, I was thinking of...
right.
Babe, I'm gonna leave.
Oh, that's right.
Baby.
Right,
I'm always nerding out on the similar songs.
That is. I'll be damned. I never realized that. I just made a new connection.
So I see you also have nowadays the Dan Peters Band. So tell us what's up with that and what you guys do and where you're playing. And
so we're playing. It developed within the last 2 years. It's still relatively new. And it's the last production of Rock of Ages that I did. It's the drummer, the bassist, and the keyboardist from that show, which was 2 years ago. We kind of formed a band out of that. And I had gotten a call to put a band together to play out. There's a really great listening room kind of club called Hey Nani in the area. And I was kind of just last minute called to put a band together to do a show there. And I invited my Rock of Ages bandmates, Janice Wallen on bass, Kara Kesselring on keys, Dan Lialli on drums. And to me, I tell everybody, it's sort of like I'm taking the funky grooves of people like Bill Withers and the Meters and combining it with Jeff Beck live at Ronnie Scott's. Like, that's the kind of vibe I want out of that. It's kind of a funky, groovy rock thing, but then ample showcase for me to play a lot of notes on guitar.
Can't wait to see it. Do you guys have any recorded music out yet?
We don't have any recorded music out yet, unfortunately. I'm working on that. I've been writing some material, and I want to get to that. I'm hoping within the year I'll have something. Even, you know, it's such a different day and age now. You know, do you release a whole album, or do you release an EP and just...
Or just a reel.
Yeah, right.
TikTok.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Guys here that I would like to see new albums from.
All right. We've got our assignments from Todd.
Okay.
Hey, Todd, thanks for hosting us today at Screaming Kitty Studios.
My pleasure.
Thank you, buddy.
And thanks for coming out, Dan, on gig day. Really appreciate it. Great to reconnect with you. You're a blazing mofo.
Oh, man.
Keep alive till you're 1,000,005, my friend.
Thank you so much, buddy, for having me. This is really an honor to be part of this. So I hope I don't sound like too much of a douchebag.
What kind of stuff are you doing tonight at your guys? A solo gig or your own band?
It's, so there's a microbrewery out near where I live. I moved last October. I'm about almost an hour west of Chicago now. Maybe 50 minutes, Huntley, Illinois, and there's every town in the U.S. has a microbrewery, it seems like, these days, or two. So this place called So Hopped, and the owner is a great guy, and so I play a lot of solo acoustic shows there, but sometimes band shows in the summer. Yeah. And the guy, I'm doing a duo tonight with a guy named Dan McGinnis, who had a really cool gig a few years back. I don't know if you guys ever crossed paths with him. He was playing, he was John Fogerty, basically. He was playing with the original drummer and bassist from CCR. I think they were touring as Creedence Revisited, like that. So Dan is, he's killer on all the CCR stuff, but just a great singer in general. So that's who I'm playing with tonight. Right. Like a playboy bunny, wanna be around you every day. Well, I'm not complaining, but it's hard behaving when your mama's sunbathing.
Whoa, guitar is safe.